This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Last week, we learned about Indiana's plan to reopen. Governor Holcomb announced that regulations would gradually loosen during a five-stage roadmap that ends on July 4th. Today, we'll find out more about this plan and what impact it might have across the state. And if you have questions or comments on our show today, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Just be sure to give us your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we will do our best to get it into the conversation and in front of our panel today. Again, that's 866-476-3881. And we have three guests today. Joining me on Skype is Joshua Vest, director of the Center for Health Policy at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Joshua, thanks for taking the time.
Pleasure to be here.
We also have the director of undergraduate epidemiology education at IUPUI School of Public Health, Shandy Dirth. Thanks for joining us, Shandy.
Thank you for the invitation.
And also on Skype, we have Brandon Smith, the State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Thanks to you, Brandon.
Always happy to do it.
Brandon, we'll just start with you. Last week, Governor Holcomb outlined the state's plan to reopen. We'll get into the details throughout the show today. But before we do, can you give us a quick summary of what he announced?
A quick summary? I don't know if I can give you a quick summary.
Well, take your time.
It is complicated, and like you mentioned, we'll talk about this throughout the show, but basically he's set out five stages. Indiana was already in stage one, which was the stay-at-home order that we'd been under for more than a month, where, you know, a lot of businesses, non-essential businesses, were mostly closed. They were encouraging working from home. Social gatherings were limited to 10 people or fewer, that sort of thing. The rest of the stages 2, 3, 4, and 5, are laid out over the next couple of months. And most of the state, not all of it, but most of the state is currently in stage 2, which runs until about May 23rd, if the timeline holds. And it's important to note that all of the timelines we'll talk about today with this back on track plan of the governor's, as he calls it, are flexible. It's sort of this is what we hope the timeline will be, but we will adjust as needed based on what we see happen throughout this process. So in this stage 2 that most of the state is under right now, some things have started to reopen. So some non-essential businesses that were closed are allowed to reopen with sort of guidelines about PPE, mask usage, hand sanitizer, social distancing, etc. Retail establishments are allowed to reopen, but only at 50% capacity, for instance, in their stores or locations. There is a larger limit on the social gatherings. So it used to be social gatherings limited to 10 people or fewer. Now it's 25 people or fewer. And then in stages 3, 4, and 5, those change. The social gathering limit grows. More businesses are allowed to reopen. Capacity limits are allowed to expand a little further, that sort of thing. So that's what we're likely to see for the next 2 months if everything proceeds as the governor hopes it does.
And we'll break down all of these stages throughout the show today. But what does it seem like their guiding philosophy is, based on what you've heard from state officials? What is their goal?
Getting back to what Holcomb has called throughout this the new normal, even under the sort of fully reopened plan that he's laid out, which is stage 5, which is not set to begin until July 4th, if, again, everything goes the way we hope it does, there's still going to be a need for social distancing. They're likely still going to suggest that you wear a mask when in public, because as we know, basically, this virus isn't going away anytime soon. And until and unless we have really a vaccine or an effective or truly effective treatment, we're not going to be able to get to the way things were before the virus hit the United States. So the goal here is, and Governor Holcomb uses the word managing a lot. We're trying to manage our way through this. Basically, a tacit admission that there are going to continue to be cases, there are going to continue to be deaths, but as long as the healthcare system in Indiana isn't overwhelmed, they are going to keep pushing forward on trying to to reopen businesses and the public and restart, at least in part, the economy.
It seems like the difference between stage one and stage two is just from looking at the plan, it looks like the biggest difference is between stage one and stage two. Was there anything surprising about what they came up with on this plan?
The most surprising thing I'd say is what it's allowing churches and houses of worship to do. So under the guidelines, as I mentioned, in stage two, businesses are allowed to be reopened, but only with the social distancing guidelines, with the capacity limits, with PPE requirements of businesses, etc. Churches and the continued limitation on social gatherings of no more than 25 people. Churches, however, are allowed to reopen this Friday, May 8th, in almost every part of the state, entirely without restriction. Now, the state is saying we encourage you to continue following social distancing guidelines, to have sanitary standards for distancing and wearing masks and cleaning regularly. We encourage that. We encourage you to continue doing online services or virtual services, if at all possible. But it's not requiring that at all. Churches and houses of worship, I should say, are allowed to reopen in almost every part of the state on May 8th without restriction, which a lot of people feel like is a recipe for disaster. And Holcomb was very candid on Monday. One, he said that the state is viewing churches and houses of worship as a test group in trying to evaluate how to move forward later on in the process. But he also said that they are putting responsibility in the hands of religious leaders to keep their congregations safe. But we know that some houses of worship were actually fined by the state or issued warnings by the state at the very least during the stay-at-home period for ignoring the state's actual requirements. So to expect them to go along with the plan now seems questionable.
When I heard about this idea that churches and houses of worship would be used as a test group, it raised flags in my own mind. I wonder if anyone else, I assume, attend the briefings often every day. And so has anyone else brought up concerns about that?
Oh, regularly. Yeah. And it was actually questions about that very concern that yielded that test group comment. Unfortunately, I think we're all in kind of a wait and see approach here. They're allowed to reopen in most parts of the state tomorrow. Presumably, worship services will happen this weekend. The problem, of course, is that if there are particularly negative consequences of churches sort of ignoring the governor's guidelines and gathering in large numbers without observing these precautions of mask wearing or social distancing or what have you, we probably won't see that sort of result in the numbers reflected for theoretically weeks, certainly days, but theoretically weeks. Now, the state is doing a lot more contact tracing than it's ever done before, which is the process by which any person who tests positive for COVID-19 will get contacted by the state of Indiana, and they will try to determine, who they had close contact with and sort of trace where they were infected potentially or who they might have infected after they became positive. And so we were hoping to learn a lot more about sort of the community spread of the disease than we have up till now. And so we might be able to learn more about, well, this church had a gathering and 30 people got sick afterwards. That's probably a sign. But again, it'll take a while for us to learn that information. So we're in a wait and see as to whether or not allowing churches to open without restrictions is the right call.
We are talking about reopening Indiana and the plan that was outlined late last week. We are talking with Brandon Smith, our Statehouse reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and we are bringing in Joshua Vest, director of the Center for Health Policy at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI, into the conversation. We're also talking with Shandy Dirth, who is director of undergraduate epidemiology education at IUPUI's School of Public Health. So, Joshua, I'll ask you the most obvious question there is right now. What do you think of Indiana's plan?
So I
appreciate the fact that we are facing two emergencies here concurrently, right? There is the clear public health emergency, but then we also have the economic and financial emergency. And, you know, any plan going forward has to address both of those very different objectives concurrently. And so that always is going to create some level of push and pull between two things that are quite different. You know, as Brandon pointed out, we are not in a point where we have a vaccine. There is no viable therapeutic. So we are having to rely on tried and true public health measures. That means something's got to come in place to address that, and that's social distancing and effective testing and effective contact tracing. I think from the perspective, well, from my perspective, the we don't really, I think, have enough data right now to know what the trajectory of the disease and level of transmission within the community is. In ongoing instances of transmission, you know, certain requirements are just really necessary, right? Like we are in what we've been doing in phase one of the governor's plan, or, you know, even the kind of current status quo with stay-at-home orders are all trying to mitigate increased risk to individuals. As right now, we really don't have as good enough data, I think, to indicate whether or not we actually are at a lower risk of transmission or what kind of true community exposure exists, because testing capabilities are just now ramping up to the levels they should be in not only here, but generally across the nation.
I want to get into more of this push and pull that you talked about, and we've got just about a minute left in this segment. We'll continue it after this, but some might think that politics making its way into this, you know, and the economy, the push and pull, of course, is public health experts are warning against reopening too soon. But then you have politicians and also business leaders saying, no, we need to reopen the economy. Is this a place where that balance can be struck, or should we really just rely on public health experts at this point?
So in my opinion, no, I think you can strike that balance, but it has to be data driven, a decision making and a phased approach.
10 more seconds.
Yeah, but the point really has to be driven by data to make that decision on where you are and what public and personal responsibilities need to be in place.
We are talking about reopening Indiana on All In today, and we will be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about the details behind Indiana's plan to reopen its economy. As always, we would love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. We're joined by three guests today. Joshua Vest is director of the Center for Health Policy at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Also from IUPUI, Shandy Dirth is the director of undergraduate epidemiology education. And we have Brandon Smith, the State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. And Joshua, my apologies. I had to cut you off earlier. We were right in the middle of talking about the balance struck between public health experts and politicians and business leaders and reopening the economy. We were just up against the break. Do you think that the policy is clear enough for people to understand right now?
So I think when you talk about, is the policy clear enough to understand? This is complicated things, right? We're talking about multiple different types of businesses. We're talking about multiple types of activities. I think we're also talking about timeframes and phases. And we're also, quite honestly, talking about diseases and statistics, right? These are this is altogether creates for a recipe for, you know, very easy to create confusion. And I guess I would also add in, it's not just simply Indiana and Indianapolis, but we have neighboring states also with their own plans and their own activities. And we have media dominated by what's going on nationally. So I think it's very easy for this to be a very confusing time for anybody to understand exactly what are the expectations, what are the challenges, what are the risks facing all of us. And so I think, you know, one of these things that comes through is effective communication is going to have to be paramount so that people both can make appropriate choices and understand what is the right course of action that we should be taking as a group.
Shandy Dearth, I want to bring you into the conversation here. You're the Director of Undergraduate Epidemiology Education at IUPUI School of Public Health. What was your reaction when you saw the state's plan?
So I can say I do like the staged approach. I like that we aren't just flipping on a switch and acting as if we can go back to the new normal. So I like the stages, and I do like how Governor Holcomb mentioned that this is not set in stone. It's flexible. They're looking at the data every day, and that's going to be critical, especially with things like churches reopening this weekend. So it's going to be very important for us to look at the data within 2 weeks to see if we're starting to see a bump in cases just because of this release on some of the social distancing.
Yeah, I mean, let's go into more on the impact you think that the reopening is going to have.
So I do expect to see more cases, but we're also seeing more cases right now just because we're testing more. We're building up that testing capability. What's important to look at is the percent of total number of cases that are showing positive. So we know a lot of younger people have reported either being having very mild symptoms or no symptoms at all, even though they've tested positive. So it's important to for us to have better testing to see just how much that's spreading and to see if we've got those kind of super spreaders out there. Are there certain groups that we need to say, we really need to watch the social distancing? And so hopefully as the data improves, we'll have a better idea of how to tweak this plan going forward.
After this announcement, a projection model that's been cited by the White House showed a huge increase in projected deaths for Indiana. The Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington projects Indiana will see 6,247 coronavirus deaths by August 4th, a week before the same model showed the state would see 971 deaths in that time, less than 1,000. If that's accurate, this would mean that the plan to reopen could cause an additional 5,276 Hoosiers to die. Shandy, does this size of an impact seem plausible?
It's not impossible. So that original model was based off of everyone kind of being in shutdown mode and having the social distancing measures in place. Everyone's working from home, the restaurants are open, the churches are closed. And so that model changed because as we're seeing the states open, that many more people are susceptible. So it is a concern. But again, I like to think that Governor Holcomb would pull back on some of these openings as he sees that number goes up. I'm sure Indiana won't wait to hit that number in August before they say, oh, we need to stop or slow this pattern. I think if in 2 weeks we see a huge increase in numbers, I think there will be conversations about stretching out these phases a little bit more here in Indiana.
I mean, this when I see numbers like that, though, and these are estimates, but they seem to be down to the numeral. How accurate are models like that? Can you tell us a bit about how they work?
So models are kind of best guesstimates with a lot of science and math behind it. And I always like to look at several models at once and average those together and look at the ones that somewhat agree with one another. Modeling is not the simplest thing to do. But again, we've followed those models for a couple of months now, and so we need to keep our eye on that. And if we do see that increase in case count, especially towards the death count, then we need to, you know, take action on that. I wouldn't ignore what that model is saying right now.
Okay, so Brandon, that was the model that was estimated by the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. What numbers, what data is the state looking at?
Yeah, I'll say two things. One, some of the modeling that group had done before about Indiana hasn't necessarily been reflected in reality here in Indiana as it played out, but which is not to say it will be inaccurate, but I can tell you, though, that the numbers that the state will be looking at specifically as they evaluate whether or not this is going the way they hope are not necessarily what we might think they are, and certainly not the numbers that some of the public gets to see. So they've said all along they expect cases to go up, not just because we are starting to reopen. But as Shandy pointed out, we are doing a lot more testing. And so naturally, those numbers will go up. As Shandy did say, one of the things that the State Health Department chief medical officer, I believe, said that she is interested in is that positive rate. So when we're testing somebody, how often are they positive? Right now, we're in the high teens, I think near 20%. She'd like to see that get a lot down to the low teens. But I will tell you that I think the numbers that the Holcomb administration will be watching most closely to determine whether they want to continue pushing forward with this reopening plan will be hospitalizations, EMS, emergency medical services runs, ICU bed availability, and ventilator availability. Some of those numbers are available to the public. Some of them are not. But it's very clear from everything that Governor Holcomb and his administration have said in the lead up to the reopening announcement, during the reopening announcement, and in the wake of that announcement, that the thing they care most about is making sure that the healthcare system is not overwhelmed, which is not to say they don't care if cases go up, but they really only seem to care in terms of potentially imposing more restrictions again if the healthcare system starts to get overwhelmed. As long as the healthcare system is there isn't a huge surge there across the state, and that could be regionally too. The governor acknowledged that some things may be able to continue on the course he's laid out in certain parts of the state while other parts of the state can't move forward right away. But as long as there isn't a surge in the healthcare system, they're going to push forward regardless of a spike in cases or deaths, as long as it doesn't too negatively impact our healthcare system.
We are talking about the plan to gradually reopen Indiana, and we are on the line with Brandon Smith. He's our State House reporter with Indiana Public Broadcasting. We also have Joshua Vest, who is the director of the Center for Health Policy at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Shandy Dirth is also with us. She's the director of undergraduate epidemiology education at IUPUI. And we have a listener voicemail from Ruth. She has a question about testing accuracy. Let's listen now.
This is Ruth. What is the accuracy rate sensitivity for the COVID-19 test that's being used on as it applies to asymptomatic individuals?
Joshua, I've seen some things as well about accuracy of testing lately. Do we know anything about that?
Yeah, so it depends on what test we're talking about in terms of the accuracy, whether you're actually testing for current active infection or if you're doing a serology test to look for, you know, if you've generated the immune antibodies and you have the immune reaction that indicates that you have been in the past. It's those latter ones, the serology tests, that people I think are fairly questioning some of the high variability in their accuracy, whether we talk about how good they are identifying folks. On the side of whether or not somebody has active disease, that is, you know, active infection, that is much more widely used and accepted. And I do not believe that it's actually dependent upon symptoms at all. It's whether you have it or not. And so that doesn't actually affect the test results.
Joshua, well, can you give us go ahead.
No, I was going to say was the what it does affect, though, is whether or not a person has symptoms. And this does relate to our testing issue, is the change in what our testing data has said over time is testing has not been, you know, just anybody or random individuals. We've shifted over time from focusing on healthcare workers to, you know, not testing everyone because we were concerned with the number of tests. So we adopted kind of a presumptive positive attitude. We've shifted to only individuals with symptoms. And of course, that excludes a whole large percent of the population who may never have symptoms or whose symptoms aren't severe enough for them to go seek testing. So one of these issues, again, with, you know, as we talk about data-driven ideas and leveraging benchmarks to help us understand whether we should be moving forward or staying put, is it's not as clean and simple as, you know, how many cases are going up or down. There's a lot of back-end stuff that fits into that that's not always immediately clear or transparent.
Let's compare what Indiana looks like as far as the plan goes to how other states around the country are doing right now. Joshua, can you give us a sense of that?
So it depends on, obviously, we got a lot of states and a lot of different options, and it's not always easy to discuss by state because states also have sometimes defaulted to their jurisdictions. So states that are very famously kind of on the forefront of being open oftentimes will rely on their major metro areas to be running on different plans. So it's not always as clear and simple. I think what we are consistent with most in the terms of a phased approach, in terms of ramping up number of contacts in a group, in a setting, size of social gatherings, what stores open up, in what order, we're fairly consistent on those points. What I think is different about our plan, and this returns back to some of the ideas of communication, our plan actually lists hard dates. And I agree with Brandon and Chandy that those are probably flexible. But in the current discussion, we've set dates instead of kind of assumed timeframes. And dates are, I think, in my opinion, a challenge because they kind of anchor expectations in people's minds. People already know July 4th. And in some ways, it may be challenging to walk back or extend or create even more confusion if those guidelines or if our benchmarks aren't made and we can't reach those timeframes.
All right. I'm going to assume that Brandon will be the best to answer this question, but if anyone else can help, then please just jump right in. Susan on Facebook says, the state is ramping up contact tracing, but at one point earlier, they had announced that supporting quarantined individuals with food, lodging, et cetera, would be up to the counties. Any progress on that? The idea that the counties will be successful at that task, Susan goes on to say, is laughable. Brandon, do we know anything about that?
When the state announced its contact tracing program, so first, contact tracing has been happening throughout Indiana throughout this entire pandemic. However, up until about now, actually, it hasn't quite started yet, but up until recently, that has been led by local health departments, which is the case in most places. What the state announced last week is that it is setting up a state-led contact tracing program. So essentially, in almost all cases, Indiana's central call center, which will be staffed by initially 500 people who will be trained on how to contact trace, the state will take the lead on contact tracing. But State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box, in announcing the launch of that call center, which will happen, I believe, next week, she said that local health departments still play a vital role here. All of the information gathered by through contact tracing at the state level will be shared with local health departments across the state so that they can be a sort of local resource for people who now are in isolation and quarantine because they have tested positive. So directly to this person's question, I believe there still is an expectation that locals will be handling local response, if you will, to folks who are in quarantine. Now, there's certainly resource sharing that's going on between the state and local governments. In addition to literally money being shared from the state down to the local government as it comes from the federal government and the various COVID relief programs that they've passed in Congress. Some of that money comes to the state, some of that money goes directly to the locals, and then the state uses its money in part to help the locals. There's also non-monetary resources that are being shared between the state and local governments and local health programs. But if she finds the idea, if the listener finds the idea that local health departments are helping people or not laughable, I don't believe anything substantially has changed in that regard in the last 2 weeks.
Shandy Dearth, Vice President Pence called Indiana's plan to reopen a model for reopening states. Are there any states that you think are handling this particularly well?
Well, again, everyone's handling the plans kind of on their own different level, looking at some of the government or the federal government recommendations. I think those who are taking time and stretching out each of these phases are probably going to be more successful in the long term. And again, I like the point brought up earlier. The fact that we gave dates on these stages does kind of anchor us to the idea that we're going to be all open by July 4th. And I would encourage people not to be upset if they're not at a 4th of July party with 600 of their closest friends here in a couple of months, just because I could see us needing to stretch that out. I think parts of New York have done better. I believe New York City has already, again, that regional approach, they've already said they're not opening their city swimming pools over the summer. They've already canceled summer camps. And I think those are some things that some of the larger metropolitan areas need to look at. I know Dr. Virginia Kane, as you guys have said, they've pushed back some of these reopening starts for Marion County because they've seen that increase in cases around the metropolitan area. So they want to be very careful and calculate it in looking at the data every day in how they reopen.
About 30 seconds left. Can we learn anything from states that are not handling it well? And do you have examples?
So I think what we saw in Georgia was that was kind of a flipping the switch situation. I'm happy to see that some of the restaurants came out and said, no, we're not going to open yet. We're not comfortable. We're not prepared. We're not ready for this yet. And so I would like to see that staged approach in each state.
We're talking about the governor's Back on Track Indiana plan with Shandy Dirth, who is the director of undergraduate epidemiology education at IUPUI. We're also talking with Joshua Vest, the director for the Center for Health Policy at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. And we have Brandon Smith, our statehouse reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, with us. We are back in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on Indiana's plan to reopen its economy, gradually rolling back its stay-at-home order. And we're joined again by Joshua Vest, director of the Center for Health Policy at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Also from IUPUI, Shandy Dirth is the director of undergraduate epidemiology education, and Brandon Smith is the statehouse reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. As always, we would love your questions and comments. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from to 866-476-3881. So Anthony on Facebook asks, what would be the trigger to pausing the roadmap, and who, how, or when would that call be made? Do we have anyone on the panel who could answer that right now?
I can get into that a little bit. We already talked about what sort of numbers the state is going to be watching closely for, the hospitalization rates, ICU bed availability, ventilator usage across the state. As for who makes that call, it's the same person who made the call on opening things up, which is the governor, obviously in consultation with his team, which includes public health leaders like State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box. But when that call might be made, we can't say for sure. They are, somebody mentioned earlier in the show that they are watching those numbers on a day-to-day basis. That is absolutely true. Some of these indicators are lagging, though. So, for instance, if the churches that meet this weekend, as I've mentioned, there is an outbreak related to one of them, we might not find out for a week or two. But I would say if you look at the dates that they have laid out so far, so Phase 2 is set to end May 23rd, with Stage 3 opening May 24th, Stage 4 June 14th, and Stage 5 July 4th. I would expect that, barring any sort of really bad spike in the healthcare system or surge, there will be a closer evaluation of the situation statewide and at a regional level just before those dates, so that they can sort of give the go-ahead on, yes, we are continuing forward the way we hoped, or, well, let's stay in stage two a little longer, or maybe even theoretically we need to go back to more of a shutdown. I don't expect that to happen barring a surge, but I think once they get closer to those dates that they've laid out in the roadmap, there will be a closer evaluation of whether or not to push forward.
We have a listener voicemail from Jenna in Muncie, Indiana, about how any correlation between churches reopening and COVID-19 cases will be monitored. Let's listen.
My name is Jenna. I'm calling from Muncie, Indiana. I would like to hear the public health expert speak to the test case of worship spaces being opened, and specifically to informed consent of congregants to participate in the test case study of opening worship spaces. Has the Indiana State Department of Health identified study participants? If so, what congregations are they? If not, why not? And how do they plan to conduct this test? Thank you.
This idea of a test group is, again, one that raised eyebrows. And so, Shandy, I'm not sure how official the test group speech is, but how might you respond to Jenna's query?
So I think she has a valid question, but I do think Governor Holcomb used that phrase not the way we researchers might use that phrase. So typically, if we're going to do a real research project, then we have informed consent, as the caller mentioned, and we have specific samples that will be tested, that sort of thing. But I don't believe the state intends to do that with any church-based population come this weekend. And so what we in public health will be doing is we'll be looking in the coming days to see if we're seeing increases in cases. And that's where that contact tracing and those case investigations play a critical role in this, because you basically at the public health level call each of these cases, you get a list of places they've been. Have you been to church? Have you been to work? Where do you go to daycare? That sort of thing. And then they will collect all of that data at the state level, and then they will be able to pinpoint any churches where we're seeing increases in cases. And I believe Josh has something to add as well.
Yeah, thanks, Shandy. I just wanted to add in, I agree. I think it was a figure of speech for that discussion. But one of the things that does make places of worship a particular risk for transmission or area of concern, it has lots of characteristics that we're trying to avoid with our practices, right? Like if you think about going to church, this is generally a high contact environment. It's where, you know, not only are you supposed to be close to people, it's actually encouraged and expected. Hugs, handshakes, right? Greeting kisses. It's in and out with large groups coming together through a single entrance and coming into the door, shaking people's hands on the way in and out. There are organizations that can, or I'm sorry, you know, structures that generally can support social distancing inside. However, it's not necessarily socially acceptable. It's kind of hard to understand how a Bible reading circle is going to be able to function really well at a 6-foot distance between everybody. It's just not structured for those things. Raise questions about lots of contact surfaces and not necessarily the type of entity that's, you know, been geared and structured for continual cleaning or setup, like a restaurant is kind of set up. So there are reasons why places of worship could be, and I guess you could even add on to that, places of worship also tend to serve an older population who are at higher risk. So you could imagine there's a lot of reasons why if cases were to increase through social, increased social gathering, this might be one venue from which it would occur.
Well, and one other point to that, a lot of times in the church settings, you have a lot of singing. And so then that 6 feet really becomes 9 feet of separation needed. And we have seen clusters of cases spread among choral groups and churches before all of the shutdowns happened. So that would definitely be another concern as well with this population.
Guy on Twitter asks, does the panel think this plan was thoughtfully put together? How can we square that with our neighbor states with better per capita numbers not opening? Why did the governor say we're in some sort of pact with said neighbors and then turn us into the canary in the coal mine? Shandy, does it seem like we might end up being a canary in a coal mine?
I think the other states are definitely going to watch us and learn from what we experience.
And Joshua, when we look at regulations, especially when it comes to private businesses and the stages that we're looking forward to, I guess how can regulations like those be enforced with private businesses?
Yeah, that's That's always a challenge. And look, I don't think most of us like being told what to do. That's just kind of universal for Americans. That's not our first practice. But I think looking at the businesses, it's very clear about why certain risk exists and why, you know, understanding who is being asked to do what. So I think, for example, that's, you know, that any good phased in plan should describe is why there's different levels of risk depending on the business. You know, for example, again, living in a world where we have no therapeutics and no vaccine, we have to rely on social distancing. So businesses that can accommodate social distancing, that's just easier. Businesses that require close, personal, intimate contact that is always within 6 feet, that just creates a higher risk. Businesses that attract large groups over, you know, for extended periods of time, congregated together, indoors, that creates increased risk. So we see, you know, lots of different reasons why these could occur, but I think that what the business community deserves and would benefit from is very clear articulation of why a particular setting or service line generates risks and is asked to do other things or wait longer than others.
We're talking about Indiana's plan to reopen its economy with Joshua Vest, director for the Center of Health Policy for Health Policy at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Shandy Dirth is the director of undergraduate epidemiology education at IUPUI. Brandon Smith is our State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Brandon, what do we know about enforcement?
Functionally, it's not going to happen. It's just not.
Short answer.
Yeah, the reality is that Indiana doesn't have anywhere near the sort of personnel capability to investigate or to be going around and checking if people and businesses are following these guidelines. Now, what the state has had up to this point is it's encouraging people to call and report what they view as violations of the stay-at-home order when we were under that to the state's the Indiana Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or IOSHA. What we know, at least what the state has told us, as of last week, through the stay-at-home order, which was over a month, the state investigated, a little over 1,200 complaints about businesses not following the stay-at-home order, whether that was essential businesses not following proper safety guidelines or non-essential businesses that weren't closing when they were supposed to. So over 1,200 complaints that the state says it investigated. It issued verbal warnings in just a little over 100. So that's less than 10% that they even thought was worth a verbal, you know, well, you shouldn't do that. And zero cease and desist orders were issued.
We have a question.
If you really think that no businesses in the state of Indiana were doing something wrong that required state intervention, man, I've got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you.
Well, and you went into, when we look, I guess, at the plan, it is difficult to differentiate between recommended and optional. I mean, just when I see those numbers, it confuses me a little bit. Is there a difference, Brandon, in what we know about what is recommended and what is optional and what that means?
Yeah, so recommended and optional specifically regards to face mask wearing by the public. Hilariously, there is no difference between recommended and optional. Functionally, you don't have to do anything if you really don't want to. Now, what the state is saying is you really should, in these first early stages, still be wearing a mask when you go out in public, in addition to following the social distancing guidelines. Whereas in the later stages, well, I guess you could if you wanted to. But functionally, again, and functionally is the important part here, because this isn't going to happen in a theoretical world. This is going to happen. And so functionally, there is no difference between the state saying you should wear a mask and the state saying you can wear a mask. In either case, it's up to the individual person.
Beth on Facebook asks, can someone explain why states are going ahead, including Indiana, that have not met the goal of reduced numbers for 14 days that was recommended by the federal government? Do we know anything about that?
So this is the logic behind it and the decision making I can't personally speak to. This is my inference is we have two indications of why we would do that. One is economic. Again, going back to we have two competing goals here within or objectives within any reopening plan. And the other is, to be quite honest, 14 days of sustained decrease in cases, and epidemiologists can discuss how you define that. That even regardless on the loosest definition, that's a high bar to reach. As Shani mentioned earlier, there's testing delays, right? From the time that somebody gets sick to the time that somebody actually goes to decide to get tested to the time those results come back in, everything's running on a delay. So to actually have confidence that you've seen 2 weeks of any direction, positive or negative, is actually a fairly high bar to reach. And that would just continually have pushed, I think, the reopening and the economic problems further along the line.
And I agree with Josh on that. I think they're relying very heavily on the fact that the healthcare system is not overwhelmed right now. So even though there were three big chunks of those federal recommendations, again, those are recommendations. They aren't requirements either. We are seeing fewer people come into the hospital, fewer people be hospitalized. We've got good syndromic surveillance right now. So since influenza-like illness is down, the flu is gone right now, we're able to track COVID easier right now than we were in, say, January, February, where all of those COVID cases were mixed in with flu cases. But again, that's where looking at the total case count, we've got to look at that percent positive. And if you look at those federal recommendations, you can look at the total case count or the percent positive. And again, that's a high bar. We're really not there yet for 14 consecutive days, but hopefully we can get to that mark. But I don't think they're being looked at evenly among these three big items.
Joshua.
I guess I would even add into what you, I agree. And again, these were recommendations in other plans, national plans put together by think tanks and others have come up with similar 2 weeks and some places even longer recommendations. But one point I think on the hospitalizations is important is we are seeing a decrease. But again, like most of our data, that's always kind of contextualized. We have for a long time in this stay-at-home order stopped transferring long-term care and nursing home residents to hospitals to be treated for COVID. That's a large percent of the people who are infected and suffering and where the high mortality rate comes through. So even there, our healthcare system is robust and has ample capacity, but we're doing extra steps to make sure that it isn't increasing from those populations.
In our last couple of minutes, let's step back and take a bigger picture view. Shandy, what do you think is the most important thing Indiana could be doing right now to mitigate the impact of the pandemic?
So I would say we need better communication about the need to wear masks. I'm not seeing a lot of people wear masks out in public. If we're going to start reopening things, we need to make hand sanitizer more available, masks the expectation, and build an infrastructure that allows for more social distancing. So think about how we're going to separate kids more when schools start back. Indiana is on that balanced calendar plan a lot of times in many districts. At the end of July, we're going to have a lot of kids together again, potentially. So we need to think about that going forward.
Shandy, are you worried about people across the state just choosing not to follow these rules and recommendations? I mean, especially as we get further into summer and things might feel like they're getting back to normal, kind of what we're talking about in about 30 seconds.
I think it's important to emphasize the fact that we're still seeing hundreds of new cases come in each day. This is not gone. As Josh noted, we're doing a lot of things to keep hospital beds open for people, but it wouldn't take a whole lot to push us over the edge again. So we need to be responsible ourselves. Wear a mask and don't go out unless you need to right now.
Shandy Dearth is Director of Undergraduate Epidemiology Education at IUPUI School of Public Health. Shandy, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you.
And thanks to Joshua Vest, Director of the Center for Health Policy at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to you, Brandon, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Brandon Smith, thanks as always.
Anytime, Matt. Thanks.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Our podcast is wherever you get podcasts. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.